Great, thank you.
This looks like too much work today.
Hey, your mic is hot. The Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Good afternoon. It's February 15th. Thank you all for coming today. If you have a cell phone with you, please consider, actually don't just consider, would you please turn it off? Because there are people all over that want to know what's happening in this hearing today, and your phones will disrupt their audio in these different places. So we have a pretty full agenda today, and Senate Bill 238, which I think many of you are here for because there are many, many, many of you signed up to speak on it. We're going to get to that last so that we can move the other hearings that have fewer people in them out faster and really spend the time that you all want to spend talking about direct support provider wages. So we are going to go in the order of Senate Bill 53, Senate Bill 102, Senate Bill 104, and then finally Senate Bill 238. And with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 53.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 53 modifies licensing fees of in-home care agencies and hospice programs.
Great, thank you. And we have Gwen Dayton, Dana Salover, and Barb Hansen. So that means you can come up to the table. And Gwen, do you want to kick it off or whatever order
Chair
you
Gelser
want?
Chair Gelser would be glad to, but I think that Dr. Salover would be the better person to go first.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Dana Salover. I'm the Section Manager for Healthcare Regulation and Quality Improvement at the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here to testify today in support of our bill to increase the fees for these two programs, the hospice programs and the in-home care programs. Basically, our section has oversight over hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, and lots of different healthcare facilities, including hospice, in-home care, and home health. And the in-home care and the home health programs are no longer supporting themselves in the regulatory work. So that is why we are here today to offer some new fees. We'd like to, in addition, we've changed the in-home care to make it more equitable. We've separated into those that do more complex things and those that do simple things, and we've changed the fees so that they reflect the amount of work that is for us, but also for the in-home care agencies proper. The in-home care fees were originally set in 2007 and haven't been changed since then. We've worked with both all the stakeholders in the in-home care to come up with some numbers that seem to make sense. Currently, there are 150 licensed in-home care agencies, and of those 150, about 121 are the highest level of complexity, and we call those comprehensive. So similarly, the hospice fees were set in 2009, and they haven't changed since then. Back then, it was the initial hospice licensing. Before that, it was only federal certification, so the hospice licensing program is relatively new to us. And there were, I think, 53 back in 2009, and now we have 61 programs. So we'll stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions and turn it over to the rest of
Thank
the
you.
Thanks.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Dayton, and I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent in-home care providers. And we're here not necessarily in direct opposition to this bill. We understand that there is a need for a fee increase, and we're not opposed to that in concept. Where we have some concerns is the level of the increase and the way that it's distributed. We're really happy to work with the agency in coming up with something that we can that meets their needs, but also we feel is equitable for in-home care providers as well. And that's really your testimony. We're engaged in dialogue. We're very happy to do that, to find something that works for everybody. And I can also answer any questions you may have.
right. Thank you. Barb.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Barb Hansen. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Hospice and Palliative Care Association. We're based out of Portland, but we cover hospice providers all over the state. And I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 53 because the Oregon Hospice and Palliative Care Association recognizes that the program licensure fees should cover the costs of administering licensure and doing the surveys. And we also recognize that, as Dr. Sullivan mentioned, that fees have not been raised since licensure was initiated. I think we first started paying in 2010. I think you may have set the fees in 2009. But anyway, I did send out an email about 10 days ago to all of the hospice leaders around the state and asked them to contact me if they had any concerns or thoughts about this bill. And I only heard back from two people, which doesn't represent apathy. I think it just shows how busy everybody is. But they both said they thought it was reasonable, and it had been a long time. So we are in support of this bill. I also think that my suggestion to the Oregon Health Authority for future consideration is to consider...
They're getting a little bit of feedback on the mic. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Perfect. For the Oregon Health Authority to consider instituting a fee schedule based on the number of patients hospices serve, because for small rural providers to have to pay the same licensure fee as larger urban providers, a difference of, say, 30 patients on service versus 500 doesn't really seem equitable. So I'm just asking for that for future consideration. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions as
you
well.
Can. Are there any questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Olson.
Docker, on the bill itself, we have a series of bold lines, meaning that they are new. Are these new fees that have never been charged before that we're adding to the list, or are these old fees that you're just increasing? My assumption is the first and not the second.
Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, these are not new fees. These are changed fees. So so they are, I have a table here that I did not offer to you, but there is a table of the old fees and the new fees. I can describe it in short if you...
And is that something you could send to us later?
Absolutely.
As well, so we can have it in the record?
Follow up. On the basic fee, that it is now $2,000, what was it?
Basic fee, in care. Yeah, Vice... Right. Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. There are two different fees. There are for the initial survey, yeah, and then for the renewal. So, and for the initial, the one that you were talking about for $2,000, it used to be $1,500 for the basic.
So, follow up. So, question: when they wrote the bill, typically when they write a bill, if there's a change, they say this is going to be the new fee. They put the new number down, and then they put the old number out there, and they say this was the old number, such as down on line 29 where it says 1500, and that means that that's gone. And I just was wondering, because when I first read this bill, to me, this looked like all brand new fees. And if that's not the case, please clarify it.
Vice Chair Olson, with Dr. Sullivan's permission, I'll try to answer that. It really is just a drafting issue. I'm putting on my lawyer hat, and long time ago worked with legislative counsel. Sometimes that will happen. They'll just simply change bracket and put the new fee. My guess in this case, because they were moving from one flat fee for all types to a fee that depended upon the level of licensure, that they just put in the new material and bracketed out the old license rather than just replace one by one.
Follow up.
Because I don't really get too excited about new fees unless the people that actually have to pay them say that they're appropriate. So are you saying that they're appropriate?
Pastor Olson, no, we are not saying that they're appropriate. We have some concerns about the level of increase and the way that the license fee is distributed. But with that, we are happy to work with the agency to find something that works for them. We do understand they haven't had an increase in quite some time. So rather than simply say no, we're trying to find something that meets all of our concerns.
Thank you. And can I just do a follow-up to your follow-up?
Sure, you can follow up my follow-up.
Thank you. So, Barb, you also represent individuals that would be paying this fee as well?
I actually don't care about that part of the bill. We only represent hospice providers.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
No, no offense.
So then I would have a follow-up to the follow-up of the follow-up. Can you tell me, in fact, then would you sit down and work to amend this bill?
Sure. We can both speak.
Well, can you both figure out which one, who's going to talk first?
What we think that we'd like to bring back to this committee.
Okay, thank you.
And do you have a timeline? I mean, do you think you could come up with an agreement by a week from today?
Yes. Chair Gressel, yes.
Okay. That sounds great. And then if you could just let me know, send me an email, and we'll get it to Matt so we can get the amendment done. All right. So a week from today, we'll hear from you. Any other questions for this panel? Seeing none. All right. Thank you all so much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 53? Seeing none. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53, and hopefully we'll get that language back and get this scheduled for a work session within the next 2 weeks. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 102.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 102 creates an adoption applicable child savings fund separate from the general fund for the deposit of specified federal funds for the use of adoption assistance payments and child welfare services, declares emergency effective on passage.
And we've got Cheryl Coons and Eric Moore. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheryl Coons. I work for the Department of Human Services as a federal policy planning and resources manager, which is just a long title that says I manage the federal funds for child welfare. I'm here. I thank you for the opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 102. This is an agency bill that is requesting to establish the Adoptions Applicable Child Savings Fund. As a bit of background, Title 4E is the primary funding source for child welfare. It provides funding for foster care, as well as adoptions assistance, guardianship assistance, but that's based on an eligible child. And then it also provides some administrative reimbursement on case management, on our training of new staff and existing staff, and I'm a little nervous.
You're doing great.
Okay. Title 4E does not provide any type of federal funding for any prevention services. It's all about when a child comes into foster care. So because of that, there are always child welfare advocates on the national scene trying to reform 4E. And based on a particular situation, the Fostering Connections to Success in Increasing Adoptions Act of 2008 was passed. And that is where there was an expansion to the adoptions assistance eligibility criteria. It allowed us to make more children eligible for 4E adoptions assistance, and it was that savings where we would normally as a state be paying general fund for that adoptions assistance, we are now able to get federal funds for that adoptions assistance. And it's that savings that the federal government is requiring us to reinvest in our child welfare Title 4E or Title 4B allowable services. This bill will allow the Department of Human Services to retain the general funds savings in a specific fund called the Adoptions Applicable Child Savings Fund and not in the normal general fund. The reason that's important is that the savings is calculated after the claim is done, the federal claim is done, and the as you know, our biennium is based on our state fiscal year, and the calculation for the savings is based on the federal fiscal year. So there's some overlap, and those savings, if not maintained and go back into the normal general fund, would cause some concern and issue with regards to being able to actually reinvest those funds. And we are, learn more about this. All states are learning more about this. We have a potential of losing our federal funds and having to pay it back, these savings, if we aren't able to maintain them, the savings, and be able to reinvest them. So the reason for the request for this particular specific fund is just so that it doesn't, we don't not lose it, but you know, it doesn't.
Go ahead.
Revert back to general fund.
And how much money are we talking about in a biennium? Do you expect would be
For this particular biennium, 17-19 biennium, we have a projected savings of $6.3 million. And it's continuing to grow because the way that the law was implemented, there was an incremental phase-in of the additional applicable children that would be eligible for adoptions assistance. It started at the age of 16 and older, and every 2 years it got a little lower. By the beginning of federal fiscal year 2018, it'll be at zero. So we continue to see more and more children are eligible for the applicable child, and therefore we continue to see more savings. And those that were eligible at the time, let's say in 2010 when it dropped down to 2014 and so on, those continue to be savings as well. So that's why we continue to see it grow.
So that's a lot of money for, when we talk about things that we want or need to do. Does the federal government say it just has to go into a savings account and then DHS individually gets to decide how to spend that money? Or could we amend this bill and use that revenue, that savings for child welfare enhancements that we're talking about doing in this policy committee as a source of revenue in order to pay for those things, whether that's a centralized child abuse assessment center, child abuse screening system, or better training for interviewers?
Yes. Chair Gelser, I'm going to defer to Eric Moore.
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Moore. Excuse me. I'm the CFO for DHS. And I'm sorry, if you could restate your...
I guess the direct question is, so we passed the bill. Does that mean DHS gets to decide on its own how to spend $6.3 million, or can we amend the bill and align it with some of the policy goals that we have that cost money this session to improve child welfare services in the state?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I think it depends. I hate to answer your question like that, but from a budget standpoint, we have a 4E waiver, and we have a cap that we've placed on our 4E expenditures for our maintenance side of the program, and expenditures on the maintenance side of the program are likely not able to be counted towards the applicable child savings. So it depends on what additional services you would be approving or spending the money on to determine whether or not it would be able to be spent on that service. A long-winded answer to say it depends on which service types. I don't think that DHS would on its own make a decision about what to spend the applicable child savings money on. This is a mechanism that would allow us to better track those funds and report back to the federal government that we have spent the applicable child savings on supplemental activities and not supplanting current funds that are already in the system.
And I guess that's the place where I'm confused. So you have the savings, the money goes into the adoption applicable child savings fund. So DHS now has this piggy bank with $6.3 million in it. You have to spend it on something new that you're not currently doing. How do you get the authorization to do that something new so that in a resource-starved system where we have a lot of things that we need to do in child welfare, the $6.3 million isn't just sitting there in the adoption savings account?
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. Yes, effectively, we wouldn't want that money to just sit in the account. We would be working with the legislative body in order to determine what types of programs would be appropriate to spend this type of money on. It's not something that we would do behind closed doors within DHS. I'm not sure that I got to your...
Yeah, I think I'm not asking the question the right way. So it can't... So the money cannot be spent for something that you're already doing. It has to be for something new because it can't... It cannot supplant. I think what I'm trying to get at is we've had a number of conversations here and we'll have others. For instance, long backlog for, we heard this the other day, investigations in our BRS system because we don't have enough investigators. Is that something that we could amend this bill to say, and the savings shall go to enhance the speed or increase the timeliness of investigations? Or we know that we need a centralized single child abuse screening hotline. Could we amend the bill to say, and the savings account will go towards that startup for the centralized child abuse hotline? Could we say we believe direct response doesn't work and puts kids in danger, so it cannot go to differential response? I mean, are there parameters from the federal government, or does the legislature have the ability, even in the policy bill, to kind of direct where that goes?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I believe that there could be amendments made if the spending was appropriate spending for this savings. And without knowing what programs are being suggested, we would have to go back and really research that to make sure that that was an appropriate spending for this savings.
And DHS would make the decision about whether that was appropriate?
We would base it on the federal law of whether it meets the Title IV-E or Title IV-B expenditure criteria.
And then one more follow-up, and then I'll go to Senator Knope. I guess that last thing, do you then have total authority over that $6.3 million, or is that contingent on the blessing or the allocation from Ways and Means to say, yes, you can spend this money on this thing?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, we would have to get limitation and have it specifically stated in a budget bill how much money could be put into the account. And, through that, we would be having discussions at the Ways and Means and in policy committees about what we would be spending the money on.
Okay. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you provide the committee with a list of qualifying services, maybe prioritized from your guys' point of view as to what that money could be spent on, so we could review that and see if it meets with legislative priorities?
Chair Gelser, Senator Knope, the Title IV-E, as I stated, is pretty limited, and so we could give you a basic definition of the types of services. Title IV-B is a little bit more broad, and so it would really be about what our, I believe, I'm going to answer this to way I believe, based on what our strategies are for the agency as far as moving forward with safety and any other initiatives. And then, of course, we could give you other things that those funds could be deemed allowable, as the federal government would say.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
And I think just building on that, really a list of these are things that are yes, these are things that are no. I think I have a concern about just kind of giving a blank check to the department without coming back to the legislature to prioritize improvement goals. Senator Olson?
Thank you. In the summary, it says that these are deposit funds of federal applicable child savings from adoption assistance payments. Are these federal dollars?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, no, they would not be federal dollars. We are not able to draw federal dollars down until we've made the expenditure. So this is really talking about the general fund savings that would be put into the account.
Follow up. So if these are general fund dollars and you've got $6.3 million in there, are these susceptible to be swept?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, anything could be swept through legislative action. So, yes, they would be.
Because they're unprotected. Follow up. They're unprotected.
Sorry, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. They would be protected, but a statutory change could sweep the account at any point.
Thank you very much.
Senator Dinbar, do you have a question? Any other questions? Great, thanks. If you could, do you know how quickly that would, within a week, that complete list, is that?
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, yes, I believe we can get that to you in a week.
Thank you. That would be fantastic.
Okay.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 102? Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 102 and opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 104.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 104 expands facilities that submit information to the Department of Human Services background check registry. The bill declares emergency and is effective on passage.
And it's Frank Miles. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Frank DeGorsardinia Miles. I'm the unit manager for the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority background check unit. BCU for short. I'll apologize ahead of time because I'm a little flu-y, so my voice may be cracking here and there.
Oh, King's X.
So sorry.
I'll stay back from
there. We go.
Do you want some water?
Oh, no, I'm fine, but thank you. SB 104 is a proposal from the Background Check Unit and Department of Human Services to amend language in ORS 443.006, Section 2, so that intellectual and developmental disability and mental health adult foster homes would be included on the long-term care registry that is currently run by the Background Check Unit, with the following benefits: maintenance of safety for clients while reducing redundant background checks, less cost in fingerprinting and other related costs from background checks, and that would be both to the agency and, in the case of capture fees, fingerprint capture fees, it would also be passed on as savings to the individuals that are actually getting checked, less hiring time for employers, and faster service times for clients served by IDD and mental health adult foster homes. House Bill 4151 from the 2014 session excluded IDD and mental health adult foster homes from the long-term care registry, despite the fact that personal support workers from both IDD and mental health are included in the registry, as well as a variety of IDD and mental health residential care. Currently, neither IDD and mental health adult foster home licensees nor prospective employees of IDD and mental health adult foster homes can tap the registry's portability benefits, thereby requiring new background checks for any individual offered positions in those adult foster homes. The exclusion creates unnecessary delays when IDD and mental health adult foster homes need to hire quickly due to staffing needs or emergent care requirements. An individual on BCU's long-term care registry has already completed a criminal history and abuse check in order to be added to the registry. Once added, the individual does not have to complete a background check to be hired for another registry-affected position during a two-year certification period. Currently, home care workers, personal support workers, residential care, nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and adult foster homes for the aging are all included on the registry. And just to give some stats from 2016 in regards to what it would look like prospectively, and with the awareness that the community is only growing in terms of services and background checks, BCU completed a total of 3,497 IDD and mental health adult foster home staff and volunteer background checks in 2016. The registry has, for the general population already included on it, has been coming in around 20.61% of candidates for registry eligible positions that were able to use that portability offered by the registry. If IDD and mental health adult foster homes had been included on the long-term care registry, approximately 721 employers in 2016 would have benefited from the portability. Equal numbers of subject individuals and at least one client per subject individual would have likewise benefited from this portability. In terms of savings, it would have resulted in approximately $58,000 to the Department of Human Services in savings. I'll open it up to questions.
And I just want to point out, in OLIS is a really helpful chart that explains how this works, how you get your passport, and it's really relevant to other conversations we've been having about how the background check unit works. Do people have questions about this really cool program?
Madam Chair, it makes perfect sense to me. I don't remember what we did in 2014 that separated IDD and mental health.
I don't recall either. I think it may have been a House bill that went to Ways and Means, and I don't know that we saw it on the side.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Olson?
No, I was just wondering. He wasn't on the side in 2014.
Yeah,
it was.
Were you? Oh, you were, weren't you? That was just a couple years ago.
Time flies when
you're
having fun.
Yeah.
So I had a couple of quick questions that we talked about in my office. And one of them was the background check. So you're called the background check unit. Is this are the abuses that you're checking, somebody has a substantiated allegation of abuse, does that go on a criminal record?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. Protective service substantiations on the adult protective service side, or founded, which are also substantiations on the child protective service side, are very private, very confidential. They do not go into criminal history. You can at times have a criminal charge that also might have been substantiated, but a substantiation by the department from either child welfare, OWAPI, or other adult protective service investigations do not appear intrinsically in a criminal record, and in general are pretty much held by the Department of Human Services, with very, very few exceptions within state agencies.
And then we also received some written testimony and some oral testimony in the committee that if a person has a substantiated allegation of abuse of any kind, that through this through the BCU, they would be forever disqualified from working in the human service system, and particularly the child welfare system, in a group home or a kids foster home or a BCU. Is that true? Is every substantiation automatically disqualifying?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, that isn't actually correct. The only things that are disqualifying are specifically criminal history that falls on either the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services list of crimes that we must mandatorily exclude, or Oregon's own 443.004 statute. Anything else goes through a weigh test, and we will take a look at a variety of factors, positive and negative, in terms of that weigh test, of which protective service history or criminal history is that does not fit within that CMS or 443 mandatory exclusion criteria. We will evaluate all of that in the weigh test against risk for the specific population. So you could very easily have a protective service founded or substantiation from the past and have done a variety of things to remediate whatever led to that, and we could approve still.
And when an employer, an adult group home, or I'm a BRS provider, do you provide information about those past substantiations? Who gets to see that information about a substantiated allegation of abuse?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, that information is confidential, and an individual could, utilizing a release of information, for example, could potentially give someone access to that, but otherwise they're the only ones that might have access.
Meaning
the individual that has the substantiation. The one exception to that currently is SB 1515 from the 2016 session, specifically for proctor foster parents of child caring agencies, can receive some of the information on substantiations. But other than that, there is absolutely no precedent for releasing that information. All that someone receives is from the employer side is an approval, a denial, or an approval with restrictions, and they do not even acquire information from the criminal history side, let alone the protective service side, in terms of what led to, for example, denial or an approval with restrictions, both which get hearing rights.
And just to clarify on that 1515, it's only the proctor foster parents where the child is living in a private home, not if you are working for a facility. The facilities don't get that information about the employees that are working for them.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, that is correct. It is only the Proctor foster parents. The members of the staff for the child caring agencies are not, or I should say the employers are not informed of that information for the staff of the child caring agencies.
And could Target or Kohl's or Bi-Mart call you and get that information?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, no, they cannot.
And last question, sometimes there's an inconclusive finding in OWAPI or in child welfare. Does that trigger a weight test? Is an inconclusive ever disqualifying or potentially disqualifying on its own?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, no. It would need to be a substantiation or a conviction, for example, before we would have even an active weigh test. If the only thing that's on a record is an unfounded or an unable to determine from the protective service side, that doesn't even open up a weigh test we would be approving.
Thank you. Senator Dimbrough.
Sorry, Madam Chair, since you've opened this line of inquiry, my curiosity's piqued. And I don't know that you're the person to know this, Frank, but do we keep records of, the outcomes of weigh tests? You know, that is, do we know of those employees who've gone through the weigh test process, which, you know, is attractive in a lot of ways, balancing different criteria? And do we know how many of the people who've gone through that have had subsequent allegations of abuse, or, you know, where there have been problems from having, you know, there haven't been hired subsequent to the weigh test, and how that might compare to the general population? You know, I'd like to get a sense of how well it's working.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dimbrough, members of the committee. This is actually a research subject that a lot of universities around the country are kind of pursuing, at least from the criminal history side, but they're also starting to take a look at the protective service side. We don't have the specific statistics. I can say that approximately 27.6%, just from quick studies within our own pool of subject individuals, necessitate a weigh test. However, while we have a percentage of denials, it's not actually as significant. We have processes for reviewing history again and starting a new background check for someone who has been approved and who has new protective service history or new criminal history. However, we've not been intrinsically tracking where that necessarily comes on in and ultimately how many are repeats from that history. What I can say from the national research is there's actually a, depending on the research study, there's between about 3 to 5 years, on, you know, depending on the study, the states, et cetera, where the curve of someone who has a felony actually becomes lower for any sort of recidivism than the common person out there on the street who has no history whatsoever. But something from the protective service side has not been run to my knowledge. And considering all the parameters that one needs to take a look at, it would be a hard study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be an interesting study.
Yes.
So, I really support the methodology of the weigh test, and I'd like to know if it leads to comparable kinds of results as, you know, as you mentioned, with felony convictions and those who go a certain percentage, a certain number of years, their recidivism rate really becomes inconsequential. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Are people comfortable with this if we set this up for a work session on Monday? Yeah. Okay, Matt, can we add that to a Monday work session, please? Great. Thank you. Anything else you want to add?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, just thank you for having me today. And I'm going to try to see if we can figure out a good way to answer Senator Dimbrough's questions for the future.
That'd be really great. And thank you for letting us turn your bill into a brief informational hearing on background checks.
Always my pleasure.
All right. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 104? Seeing none. Thank you again. This is really, really great work. So I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 104. And let's quickly open up a work session on introduction of committee measures before we open our big hearing. So opening up a work session on introduction of committee measures.
Chair Gelser, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. Legislative Concept 3606, dated 2-8-2017, and Legislative Concept 2735, dated 11-21-2016.
Vice Chair Olson has moved that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3606, dated 2-8-2017, and LC 2735, dated 11-21-2016. Is there any discussion? Also, a vote for introduction is not a vote on the merits or on the content of a concept, nor does it guarantee the draft will be referred back to this committee, nor that it will be scheduled for a hearing, or that anybody that supports it here today would ever support it in the future. Is there any objection to introducing them as committee measures? Seeing none, they are introduced as committee bills. And I'll close the work session on the introduction of committee bills and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 238.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 238 requires the Department of Human Services to pay contracting entities an amount sufficient to cover 150% of minimum wage for certain direct support professionals. It requires DHS to provide online training for certain direct support professionals using a specified curriculum. It sets an operative date of January 1st, 2018, and it sunsets the online training requirements for January 2nd, 2020. It also appropriates funds, and it declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Great, thank you very much. For the primary proponents of the bill, do you have an order that you want? Do you want me to start, Chris and Joanne, with your panel? Does that, to kick it off? Okay, so let's start off with Chris Burnett, Joanne Furman, and Jeff Carr. Yeah. Thank you. Welcome. Those are big buttons.
Yes, they are. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Chris Burnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Resource Association. We represent over 60 community provider agencies across Oregon who provide comprehensive 24-hour supports to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We're here to talk about a bill that has been supported by the entire DD network, community network, that includes the DD Coalition, the Oregon Association of Community Mental Health Providers, the Oregon Support Services Association, and the Community Providers Association of Oregon, some of whom will testify here today and many of whom submitted testimony. So we're here to talk about the direct care workforce crisis. A couple of months ago, we initiated a campaign called the State of Emergency, which you see depicted on our buttons. And that is because there is such a dire shortage of direct care professionals, particularly in the comprehensive 24-hour support system. This is both residential. These same DSPs help people find and retain jobs and provide supports for those who are not working. So why do we have a crisis? There has been, over time, over years, lack of funding, Medicaid funding, for the wages for direct support professionals in this comprehensive system. That has resulted in an exodus of DSPs, direct support professionals, the ones who provide the direct care on a day-to-day basis to people, to other positions that pay higher wages. This is a complex job. It requires a unique set of skills, and a good DSP is not easy to come by. So why it's a crisis as well is we are now at the point where people, agencies, I would say, have to say no to when they get a referral from case managers. They say no not because they're making a protest statement. They say no because they simply don't have the staff to support them. So where do people go? They can end up on the street, homeless. They can end up in jail, in hospitals, in emergency rooms, places where they are not going to get the support that they need. That's why we feel this is a crisis, and it's the crux of the purpose for the bill. The workforce shortage is also based on the fact that agencies are funded by Medicaid, and they just can't raise their rates because they need to compete in a more competitive employment market. They are paid fixed Medicaid rates, and those have not kept up with the cost of recruiting and retaining qualified staff. So what we proposed in this bill is a long-term strategy that's tied to the minimum wage increases and keeps this professional qualified staff well above minimum wage, enough above minimum wage, I won't say well above minimum wage, to keep them in their jobs of choice and to reduce the impact on people being supported, because that's really the heart of the matter as well. A lot of staff turnover is traumatic and painful, and you'll hear more about that in others' testimony, but that's pretty much the crux of my comments, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, why don't we do the panel before we go to the questions?
Hello, Senator Gelsler, members of the committee. Thank you for the chance to speak today. My name is Joanne Furman. I am the co-founder and associate director for Partnerships in Community Living. PCL serves over 300 people in a variety of counties throughout the state, and we employ approximately 600 direct support professionals. I thank you for the opportunity to support Senate Bill 238. So I know there's lots of questions about how we got here. I know there's lots of mixed messages about what's in a DSP rate, what's in our rate model, how it's factored in, and how those things work. And we share those questions. Personally, I spent a lot of time working on this issue, trying to figure out. Recently, we discovered that the rate model had a different wage number in it than we had thought for many, many years. So we dove into that to figure out why is that happening, and if that's the case, why aren't we paying? Why don't we have the funds to pay those different wages? Really, what we found is complicated, and there's really not time today to dig into that, but I'll tell you it's basically related to hours, the number of hours in each rate, what's that versus in the funds for the DSPs. For example, a quick example for PCL, we're providing about 35% more hours that people need. I'm not saying they don't need it. That's in the rate model. That results in us spending about $2.2 million per year above our funded service payments to provide those. Interestingly enough, in order for me to give a $2 an hour increase, which I would love to do today, I would need about $2.4 million in a year to do that. So those numbers they really play out to me that the rate model is really way more complicated than one simple factor. So I want to jump ahead out of data. I will send you lots of data around that. But today I really want to talk about what's really important. And what's important is PCL's mission and values. And providing great service to the people we support. And we know we can't do that without great DSPs, which is why DSP wages is really our number one commitment. I have some testimony I'll give you that shows you a graph over the last 10 years, and it's always been a priority to us. PCL has never gone a year without providing increases in some form to our DSPs, no matter how small they are, but we always make sure that that's our first priority, why others haven't. So just one last quick dollar number before I get into the heart of the matter is just last year we spent over $1.5 million on overtime, and that's around just not having enough DSPs to fill the needed positions to make sure people's needs are met. What's important is the work and how this affects, as important if not more than the financials, how this affects people we support. DSPs are much more than caregivers. They provide support in all aspects of someone's life. They're there for the fun, not just the fun times when we're celebrating great things and enjoying things, but they help people through some really difficult times. They help them navigate complicated mental health systems, complicated healthcare systems, deal with anger and frustration and how to manage that in a way that works for them. They're grief counselors when the people we support lose someone they love. And sadly, they do intimate care. And oftentimes, our young DSPs, dedicated DSPs, are the ones holding someone's hand, helping them through end of life. It is not a minimum wage job. This requires people who really, it requires real skill, commitment, and background education. DSPs is not just the right thing to do. Investing in wages is not just a good thing to do. It's not just the right thing to do. It's a fiscally smart thing to do. right? If we were able to secure this process, we will save money in staffing. We will save money in recruitment. We will save money in training. And in turn, that money gets reinvested into wages. That is what our mission drives us to do, and that's what we do. It is a win for our system. It is a win for our state. And more importantly, it is a win for the people we support because they get solid, great DSPs. So I want to leave you just one story because I always have to do that, right? And I'll, on the testimony, you'll have her picture that I sent you, but I want to talk about a woman we need to support. Her name is Janice. And this is the real benefit. I'm going to give you a good story here to when you have great long-term staff. PCL served Janice for 27 years. Recently, Janice passed away, and I was at her celebration of life. And it was just beautiful, I'm telling you, the stories that people told. Janice had DSPs that had been with her for 16, 17, and 20 years throughout her life. They told stories of all the adventures they shared. It was motivating. It was just moving to see people talk about and celebrate a life well lived. And I was really stunned by the fact that when Janice first came into our service, she was labeled as difficult, challenging, hard to serve, and really unable to live in our community, right? So these labels are what she came with, but they're not her legacy. Her legacy is the fun that she had, the love that she shared, and the gifts that she shared with our communities. So I celebrated that and felt so proud of that in that moment. And then I was also struck with sadness by the number of people we support who don't have that story, who have staff turnover, who don't have people who know their story, who know how to change that label, and who can help that person share their legacy. And I hope you'll help us do that by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Carr, and I'm the new CEO at Albertina Kerr, which has been around since 1907 and been serving vulnerable people for the last 110 years in Western Oregon. Today, we provide programs and services to children and adults with mental health challenges and developmental disabilities. We operate 48 group homes, a number of day programs, and employment services for kids and adults with developmental disabilities. And we employ over 800 people, of which about 400 are direct support professionals who make between $11 and $14 an hour. And they really are, as my colleague said, the people that are on the front lines. And since I got here 8 months ago, I've spent lots of time visiting our employees and talking to them, seeing their work, hearing their stories, and their relationships with many of the people that we support. But I've also heard them tell their stories about their own challenges in their own lives. And when we think about folks with developmental disabilities being people who are vulnerable, the ironic thing is that the people who actually we are employing to serve those people are in some ways as vulnerable in different ways, but vulnerable themselves. About 40 days after I got here, I found out that we had a mom with 5 children who was working full-time for us, who was in a tent living outside because she'd been evicted from her apartment because she couldn't afford to pay the rent. And there are many stories like that, not only of people who work with us that are struggling, who we were able to help her when I found out that, but who are really struggling with food security, how they're going to continue to pay their rent because of the wages. And I included in my testimony some charts and some information related to the DSPs at Albertina Kerr just to give you a sense of the crisis. We did some analysis over the last 5 years in terms of what the rates have been, in terms of our vacancy rate, our turnover rate, and I think that data really shows that, as our head of HR said, we've had a low grade fever for a long time, and that fever now has exploded and it's at full force. Our turnover rate has increased from 25% 5 years ago to a current rate of 61% turnover amongst our DSPs. Our vacancy rate has doubled from 7% to 14%, which obviously translates into greater training and recruitment costs. It also, as my colleague said, increases our overtime costs because we have to have coverage to support the people that we serve. And it also, as she mentioned, it really it reduces the stability of relationships between the staff, the people who are there to serve the people we support, and the people themselves, which then doesn't allow them to develop the depth of relationships and that enables them to really support their goals and help them really be effective in their change plan. When you look at the rates increase, the cumulative rates have increased 5.1% over the last number of years. We took a dip in about 4 years ago, and then they were brought back up. At the same time, we've increased our wages 22.6%. And we also pay 100% of all the costs of our employees' medical, their dental, and their vision, which presently costs about $498 per month per employee. And those expenses, those benefit rates, have actually increased by 46% over the same time frame. So I'm confident that you all are smart enough to understand that these numbers just aren't sustainable for us. If we're going to keep this system afloat, and not just afloat, but actually help it be a system of care that makes sure it helps really the vulnerable people of our state. And I recognize that you face difficult budgetary decisions in this legislative session. But I would say that budgets are moral documents. They reflect all of our values, whether it's a budget in our family or a budget for our state. And I urge you to support SB 238 because I think it's a way that we can support long-term stability for the wages for the people that serve the most vulnerable in our state. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to share our story with you today.
Great. Thank you so much. Are there any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, and anyone can answer this. If we look at this problem, this is a statewide problem, right? Are there differences regionally in the severity of the problem of finding, retaining DSPs?
Yes, if I can answer that. Thank you, Chair Gelzer and Senator Dembro and members of the committee. There is a crisis across the entire state. It may look a little different in Portland because in order to recruit and retain a higher wage because of the competition is required, but the same problem occurs in Eastern Oregon and Central Oregon and Southern Oregon because, equally there's, lack of accessibility. It may be a different dollar figure per se because of the, whatever the competitive market level will be. But I would say it's statewide. In fact, it's a national problem and is an issue across the entire country. And I will ask if I can add one or two small points from my testimony quickly.
Really quick, because I want to make sure we get through everybody that came, but of course.
I just want to address in other testimony that you will hear, I feel like there are some alternative facts that need to be addressed. I think there is a misunderstanding in what is a starting orientation wage and an average wage and the nuances of the rate system. I think it's important for you to know that there is transparency in the system, and we've been working hard with DHS. Lilia in particular, and I give her credit for initiating a whole overhaul of the rate system so that there is a rate methodology that everybody can understand and that what could be flexible and transparent for everyone. So I just want to make sure you knew that.
All right. Thank you very much. Any further questions?
Can I ask one more?
Of course you can.
Thank you. Sorry.
Because you were the first person here today.
That's true. The bill references 150% of the state minimum wage. And, of course, with our new minimum wage system, we actually don't have a minimum wage. We have three levels depending on where the business is located. Mm-hmm. And so I assume that that's taken into consideration here.
It is. Yeah. It is. And I know DHS is currently costing out what that would be. And we put a chart on the back of our fact sheet that gives you an idea of where the rates would go.
And the goal, then, is to keep the wages competitive with the communities in which they're located.
Right, so that DSPs can actually stay doing the job that they want to do. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Next up, we have Desiree Rivera, Sharon Lofton, and Kendra Morgan, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Desiree Rivera.
It's nice to meet you, Desiree. Thanks for coming.
I'm here to support my staff and
Just take a breath.
I'm a little nervous.
You know what? You are doing fantastic. Best person yet today.
Well, I'm here to represent my staff, and I need.
Okay, when we were talking the other day, and you were talking about concerns that you had pertaining to your staff, you want to tell them about that?
Well, I'm here to support my staff at PCL. I want them to have money and support people in PCL and
Can I ask you a question, Desiree?
Yes.
So why is it important to you to have kind of a staff people that you know over a period of time or that you can count on? What makes that important to you?
That they are important to me. They take me places. They take me to the crop center. They take me to movies, and they take me everywhere.
And what's it like for you when you get a new staff person? If somebody has to leave their job, what's that like for your life when that happens?
Well, I don't want my staff to leave. I want them to have money to stay. I want them to stay, and so they won't leave.
Great, thank you so much. Are there other things you want to add?
Well, I want to represent Andy. I'm representing Andy because we need more money to survive. I don't want my staff leaving. I want them to have personal money and stuff so they can stay. We had a lot of people leave.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking the other night, and you were letting us know what you felt we did for you, would you like to share some of the things that you like your staff to be available for in the job that we do?
Well, they take me places. They take me to just start to buy things, and they take me to the stores, and they take me to the crop center. They take me to work, so I have money to spend.
Good. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your coming. Will you stay at the table while the others talk too, in case we have questions for you at the end?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yay, I did it!
That was exceptionally well done. You could do a training for other people.
John Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Sharon Lofton, and I am a DSP, a direct support professional. I am employed by PCL, Partnerships in Community Living, and I have been there for 8 years. When I began my career there 8 years ago, I did not know if I would like that. But it has really proven to be a very satisfying career. And I think it's because the difference that I see that I make in somebody's life, their quality of life is improved. And that, to me, that self-satisfaction is worth its weight in gold. I have considerable experience in the healthcare field as a CNA, a certified nurse aide, and I've raised my family. And both of these experiences have been valuable and very applicable to my job as a DSP. Just out of curiosity, I researched the wage at the facility that I used to be a CNA and found that it was $14.74. Well, that's more than I make now. Anyway, just a side issue. From my perspective, DSP has a lot of responsibility. DSP performs tasks like a CNA, an MA, which is a medical assistant, because we dispense meds and attend all kinds of doctor's appointments with them to advocate. We're a counselor. We help people work through tough times in their life. We're family and we're friends. All of these things rolled up in one job description. There is much responsibility, but not compensation. I have observed a balance between wage and longevity. DSP's wage of today doesn't really encourage longevity. There is a high turnover because employees are always looking for a better job. Thus, the low retention, and this in turn drastically affects the ones that we support. People supported that have staff that remain for long periods of time, as Joanne testified, they seem to thrive and they're secure. But likewise, the inverse is true as well, that when there's a high turnover of staff, it causes a rise in challenging behaviors and ultimately feelings of insecurity, a lot of anxiety, and there's just a lack of trusting relationships. And I thought of an illustration that to show the emotional impact, and it compares, or it's an analogy to help clarify it, in regards to child care and the caregiver relationship. Can you imagine the impact of changing a caregiver every other month? Sometimes our DSPs are changing much more often than that. Anyway, there's not enough time to build trust, and there's barely enough time for a child to feel comfortable. Last year, I was given a wonderful opportunity of training by my employer. PCL made it possible for me to study, work, and achieve my DSP Level 1 credential, and that was through the National Alliance of Direct Support Professionals. This organization is from the East Coast, and last year was the first group, I think it was approximately 10 of us, that achieved our credentialing on the West Coast, and they were the first ones. Our study was accomplished through the online classes, which were really great, and approximately 60 hours, to give you an idea. And I feel that was a very valuable tool for myself as a DSP, primarily because I could integrate that into my work schedule. And the College of Direct Supports was really a great online learning support. In closing, I really wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 238, not only for the advancement of the DSP, but the trickle-down effect of increasing the quality of life of those adults that we support with physical, intellectual, and developmental disabilities. I'd welcome any questions that you might have of me. I'd be glad to try to answer those.
Thank you. And we'll finish the panel first and come back.
Great
questions. Thank you. Kendra. Great.
Thank you. Kendra Morgan from Shangri-La here in Salem. Chair Gessler and Senator Olson, members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to come and present testimony today. Funding the DSP wages at 150% of the minimum wage would ensure individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities are healthy and safe at work, at home, and in their communities, while also providing a just wage for the dedicated professionals working in this field. Stabilizing this workforce is critical. As a provider agency, we are suffering the impact caused by the rates that only fund a poverty wage. Historically, in our employment department, for example, we were able to fill positions within 2 weeks. Now it's taking as much as 6 months to fill positions, impeding our ability to provide the level of support to ensure the greatest level of support or success for the individuals we serve. So we have these emails that come out, and it's always a celebration, and they're called a happy dance, and it's basically celebrating when people get jobs in the community, which is a huge focus. The sad thing about it is that we're suffering because we can't keep our job coach positions filled, and those job coaches are essential to ensure retention rates for those people that are working in the community. So our employment specialists are working dual roles and long hours, which is costing us additional funds. Additionally, our conservative estimates for the cost of turnover with an open position of 1 week for one position is approximately $5,000. This increases exponentially when the position remains open longer. So as you can imagine, the cost of a position being open for 6 months is pretty extensive. It's also our belief that many of our direct support professionals, which you heard testimony about today, depend on government benefits or are suffering themselves. We believe that shifting these resources to provide a living family wage would help reduce the incidence of homelessness and people dependent on other government benefits, which only makes sense to us. Finally, it's our belief that stabilizing the workforce is ultimately good for the people that we support. With any professional staff, as they stay in their profession, they become more knowledgeable and skilled, and so it makes sense that we would try to stabilize the workforce and ensure retention. So I appreciate you the opportunity to speak today, and we're open for questions and supplying any data that you might be interested in.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? And then thank you all very much. Great job.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, next up we have Alan Crest, John from Multnomah County, and where's my other number three? Renee Bendix.
Shall I start? Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, thank you for your service. My name is Alan Kress. I'm the CEO of Southern Oregon Aspire in Grants Pass. Currently, Southern Oregon Aspire supports close to 250 adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We provide opportunities for them to live and work, and I would dare say even thrive in their communities. I love hearing the stories. When they'll talk about their lives today, they'll talk about what it's like to choose the communities they live in. They'll talk about how they can choose their friends. They can choose how they recreate. They can choose where and how they worship. And if they're feeling a little rebellious, they can choose to have dessert before dinner if they want. When I hear them talk about or contrast this against their time growing up, for many of them, in the old institutional setting, that word choice wasn't a part of their daily vocabulary. The only reason this is possible today is because they're supported by a dedicated group of DSPs. We've heard a little bit of testimony today that talked about what these DSPs do. There's this perception out there, I think, that DSPs are kind of unskilled labor, and that is the furthest thing from the truth. These are trained professionals. These are people who are trained to support people with everything from budgeting to all their activities of daily life, and frankly, everything in between. The DSPs that we work with, they make barely over minimum wage, and that results in a significant turnover. You've heard some turnover numbers today. We feel, after listening to some testimony today, I feel very fortunate to have a 41% turnover, but that's an improvement over last year, and it beats the heck out of some reported turnover throughout the state. And again, this is not just a problem for Southern Oregon Aspire. This is throughout the state and throughout the nation. And this impacts the people we support. Every time we have DSP turnover, we have to remember that for many people in services, this paid staff represents the bulk of the people closely associated with them. When they have turnover, imagine losing your friends every 6 months, every year, and every other year, and having to start over. I couldn't imagine that. I don't know what kind of behaviors I would demonstrate. So I don't really fault people who struggle with that. I brought two of our DSPs with me today. One's been in services. One's been doing this kind of work for about 3 years, Megan. And Janice has been doing this for over 30 years. The fact that they've both stuck with us, despite this difficult lives they lead because of the pay, I'm going to go so far as to say that they're subsidizing our DD services system by being willing to stay in this for the rate they're paid. Both of them could leave here. They're both very sharp young ladies. They could both leave and get paid a lot more than they do today. I'm grateful that they serve here, and they're just two of quite literally thousands across the state who are willing to do that. They make personal sacrifices to be able to support the people they love. And when I say love, I don't use that term lightly. That's that one qualification that doesn't show up on our job description, that's probably the most significant qualification. I will personally urge you to support Senate Bill 238 and recognize the valuable work that our DSPs do.
Thank you very much.
I'm John from Multnomah County, Somerville. I'd like to thank Chairman Gelser and Vice Chair Olson and the committee for allowing me to speak here today. I'm kind of concerned about, I'm a DSP provider. I'm a resident manager of a facility up in Multnomah County, formerly a paramedic and worked about 14,000 hours in emergency rooms. I'm a qualified mental health associate. I currently work for a very good provider who pays very well and does what she needs to do. Formerly, prior to this, I was working for another provider who currently owes me $105,000 in back wages. She's been sued by, or they've been sued by four former employees for the same thing over and over again. My concern is, if the providers get these funding, what sort of provisions are in place to ensure they're trickled down to the employees and the DSP professionals? Here's a facility right now that has an individual paid $3,500 a month who's not even there. It's being done to cover up their bankruptcy to avoid paying me my wages. They have people that are in their family. On-site inspections done by Clackamas County DHS shows this person is not even there, and he's getting paid $42,000 a year. I have concerns that this will continue on in this type of level. I've seen this happen in other facilities before, too. What happens to the DSP workers that can't get paid at all?
So are you able to provide us the written materials that you,
Yeah, I have documentation. I've worked with DHS on this. There's been some things going back and forth. A caseworker. Another thing I saw and witnessed there, the case manager for Clackamas County sits on the board of directors for the Senior Citizens Council of Clackamas County. She's formerly head of the ARC in Multnomah County. She also sits on the board of directors for Rainbow County, or Rainbow House out in Multnomah County. She was using her position to provide her son a job, taking one client down to the beach, wherever, staying in a penthouse at a rate of $25 an hour around the clock. While other people there, I was getting less than $800 a month. And she had another person coming in prior to that, who's a case manager for the Department of Human Services, also taking the same client out at a rate of $20 an hour on weekend trips and things. There's no accountability.
So why don't we follow up afterwards? And it would be great after the hearing if you wouldn't mind going up to my office on the fourth floor, and Angela can set up some time for us to talk and go through the materials and see what more we can find out about that. Those are things worth looking into.
It is.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Renee Bendix, and I am the parent of a 21-year-old son that has been significantly impaired by autism. His name is Cooper, and he lives in 24-hour residential care with PCL. I wanted to give you a quick snapshot of my son so that this testimony has a frame of reference. Cooper is 6 feet tall, and he weighs about 215 pounds. He has very limited expressive language, but his receptive language skills are much better. He is happiest when he's busy and helpful. When he is happy, he is very enjoyable to be around and charms the people around him. When Cooper is angry, it's a different story. He is angriest when he is anxious, when he is ignored, and when his triggers are set off. When Cooper is angry, he is known to shove people or children or destroy property such as clothing, bedding, towels, or household items. Most of those are his own. Angry Cooper can happen very quickly. Thankfully, angry Cooper doesn't happen as frequently now as it used to. As a parent, it's hard to give up the daily responsibility and care of your child, especially one with special needs who has limited language. I have to trust that the people supporting him are kind, honest, and have his best interest in mind. I want him to be safe, valued, enriched, and happy. That sounds pretty simple. But it's the non-basic job duties that are even more critical for my peace of mind as a parent. Let me give you a scenario. One of Cooper's staff took him to a local park here in Salem last summer. They were walking the path along the river. On this particular day, there was a family with a young girl in the general vicinity of where Cooper was walking. Cooper's staff know that crying children can be a trigger for Cooper and that he can be react very negatively to the noise. The young girl, though, was playing very peacefully. Cooper's staff knows to stay within arm's reach of him when they're out in the public and to monitor his surroundings and look for those sorts of triggers. For an unknown reason, Cooper quickly darted to the family and knocked the girl to the ground. The father immediately and rightfully became angry and confrontational with Cooper. His staff had to try to calmly explain Cooper while using restraint on Cooper, force the safety of those around him. This meant that the staff also had to place themselves between Cooper and a very angry parent. The police were called, and luckily the officer that responded was reasonable and explained that pressing charges would not be meaningful or appropriate in this situation. The ordeal was very volatile, and had the staff not handled it appropriately, there could have been an altercation, and Cooper could now have a criminal record. This is one of my worst nightmares as a parent. DSPs aren't entry-level employees. Their value shouldn't be compared to a fast food worker or a car wash attendant. They're asked to be record keepers, event planners, security officers, problem solvers, chauffeurs and cooks, appointment keepers, and even hygiene supervisors. They may clean up feces and vomit. They are trained in restraint. They may be physically assaulted or have their own personal property ruined by the people they support. These are not easy things to talk about or even think about when discussing people with special needs, but it is a reality. It's a reality for my son. And it's the reality of the people that support him. DSPs are asked to do all of this in a positive manner, even on the very worst day. And I think this is a lot to ask of a minimum wage employee. Why would anyone want to do this kind of work for minimum wage? Recruiting qualified people as DSPs is difficult. You've heard lots of testimony about that today. Retaining them is even harder. I want my son to be cared for by competent staff who are paid well enough to remain in their positions for the hard work they perform. Staff turnover is very stressful for my son. The learning curve is long for DSPs, and it takes weeks before things go smoothly with new staff. All of this adds chaos to my son's life, and chaos equals behavior issues. Please consider passing this bill so the agencies can pay DSPs appropriately for the work they are asked to perform. My son deserves highly qualified staff, and if you have a loved one supported by a DSP, then your loved one deserves the same. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, next up, I can't tell where the line, Eva, are you part of this panel? You are? Okay, great. So Eva Ripito, Devin Thurman, Gordon DiCatro, and Emily Sikulski. I couldn't tell if the line ended in the middle of your name or at the line underneath.
My apologies.
What?
My apologies. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thanks so much for the opportunity to provide testimony today on Senate Bill 238. My name is Eva Ripito. I'm with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent IDD workers at Local 3213, which is Albertina Kerr in Marion County, Local 2746-3, which is Coast Rehabilitation, Local 1766, sorry, I'm reading it. I just didn't want to forget anybody. Local 1766, which is Rainbow Adult Living, and Local 3505, Star of Hope. And of course, Local 1246, the Stabilization and Crisis Unit, which are the state operated group homes that care for the people who have no other options for placements or housing.
AFSCME is supportive of the intent and to raise the wages of direct care staff and provide training. I could not agree more with that it's a crisis. With the previous testimony about it being a crisis, high turnover. We hear from our members repeatedly about the high turnover that they see in the field across the whole system, and that how wages and lack of training are directly related to that turnover. I appreciate very much that people have given a very honest and accurate description about how difficult the work is. I can't even imagine. And one thing I know is that the people who stick with it care very deeply and are very passionate about the work too. And that shouldn't be the only reason why they stay. They should be able to make a living wage as well. Like others who have provided testimony and will be providing testimony, I would love to have the language that increases for providing support go to the people doing the work in the form of wages. I understand that there is data that shows that money has been passed through, but in some cases it wasn't without a fight and without legislators reminding them, the agencies, that the directive was for increased wages to go to direct care workers. For some, this fight continues, and including with AFSCME Local 3213, they're currently in negotiations with the main sticking point around wages. I'll just continue to take a high road. Very upset about some of the other things that have been said. On the language around training in SB 238, I do have some serious concerns. Primary is that the language calls to follow the National Alliance for Direct Support Professionals Code of Ethics and Curriculum. I know that NADESP is a well-known and respected entity, but I have concerns about how this could potentially circumvent our state's public contracting practices and laws. It puts a private entity into statute. I know that this has been an issue in other areas, and I've been told that we typically don't do that sort of thing. Additionally, I have concerns that the training is online only. Members across the state have said that some training online may be appropriate, but that in-person and hands-on training is what's most needed. Our IDD support workers throughout the system need access to affordable, meaningful training. I've asked both on and off the record if it would make sense to build a professional development system that mirrors what's available for childcare and early learning workforce. Their system is called the Oregon Registry Online, and it is housed at Portland State University. All trainings are approved and validated by staff who work with master trainers on their proposed curriculum. The trainings are provided by people around the state who have expertise in the field. They are both in person and online and range from food handling, first aid, and CPR to providing inclusive care, best business practices, and how to handle implicit bias, and many other courses as well. This system has levels and steps that people can track progress in their training. It is responsive to the needs of the workforce by providing the basics that will never go away to current topics and best practices for care. I believe our IDD workforce would benefit greatly from a system like this. Above all, to do any of this, wages and training, we need revenue, which I know that's not your job here, but I feel like I need to say it repeatedly. And I appreciate very much that this conversation is happening, and I'm happy to participate in continued discussions around wage increases for direct care professionals and how to provide them training. Thank you.
Thank you, Eva. I don't know which direction you want to go next.
I'll go first.
All right.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and the members of the committee, my name is Devin Thurman, and I am also a direct support professional and a relief staff at Partnerships in Community Living. I'm here today to kind of address my own concerns about pay, staffing, and training. I've worked for Partnerships in Community Living for 4 years now, and I feel that these are the major areas that need to be addressed. The most important to me is the lack of staffing, as a lot of us have talked about today. But a big part of this is personally, and from being able to see so many different workers, low wages are absolutely the biggest fight for direct support staff. While I understand that wages are a big part of the reason we're short on staff, I feel that there needs to be more levers in the system that allow for transparency for this whole community, not just for direct staff. As a relief staff, I'm frequently moved from home to home based on where the staffing needs are. So whether that be for call-outs or to cover just big openings that come from the large amount of turnover that we have. Between what oftentimes boils down to poor communication and then the lack of available staff, the people that we support are the people that are suffering from this. They've been repeatedly left high and dry without the adequate need or the adequate support that they need. And it's an extreme need for more direct support workers. I personally had to work at a home in Salem with three people whom I had never met and had not been trained in the supports that they needed. And while personally I feel that I'm an adaptable person and might be able to wing a shift like this and get to know them, I know that that is not a comfortable situation for anyone to be in, to have strangers come into your home multiple times a week and to try to build relationships over and over again. To exacerbate situations like this too, with so many different people with the staffing problems, we may not even be able to accommodate trips out into the community with the staffing requirements that we need. The biggest priority of a direct staff like myself is to support the people we work with so that they can have fulfilling and exciting lives and be able to go out and build relationships in the community. And we can't do that without adequately trained staff and people that are willing to stay and do it. And with a lack of access to the kind of training like the NADSP program for everyone, and with a lack of real transparency in the system, we're frequently grasping at straws to meet the minimum requirements for the people that we support. It is imperative that there's more concrete regulation and accountability behind staff training and a change to the system that provides funds for the people we support. I believe that this is a really important field, and I think that every day that I'm doing something important, and even more so that the people that we support are able to get the adequate help that they need. In order to achieve this, I think we need to do more than just raise the wages for people. I think that it is important to make sure that there is accountability to assure that the rates are being given to direct support staff. And to have better access to quality training. We need stronger workplace protections and regulations set in to assure that workers have a voice. Not everyone can come out and talk here. And that most importantly, that the people that we support are able to live independently and with dignity. And thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill.
Thank you so much.
Hi. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Gordon DiQuattro. I am also a direct support professional. I work at Albert Taylor down in Eugene, Springfield. I want to say that I'm deeply sympathetic with the intent of this bill, but I am also deeply concerned about its potential implementation. As a group home worker, I really understand the need for increased wages. It's badly needed. One of my best friends is a fantastic DSP, and she works regularly 40 to 60 hours a week, and she lives with her partner in a room in somebody else's home, and she can still barely afford to keep everything together and to make all ends meet. When somebody is in an environment like that, where somebody is caring for another person during their work time and then has to worry on their time off about how they're going to care for themselves, it necessarily limits their capacity for patience, for compassion, for vigilance, all very important skills in DSP work. And it's no fault at all of the individuals who are working. This obviously translates into epidemic level turnover in the field. And this results in the loss of good staff. And unfortunately, it often results in the loss of good friends for the individuals that we support. So as much as I support the rhetoric of this bill, I do know from experience that if the state does not stipulate directly that these funds go to wage increases for DSP, it's likely that that we will not see them passed on to us. As you know, last year we were able to get a 4% increase that was stipulated to go to worker compensation, but even that wasn't necessarily clear enough language. As soon as that happened, we got an email at Alfred Taylor saying that rising health care costs would result in the absorption of the 4% increase and that we shouldn't expect to see anything. Thankfully, we have a union. We were able to stop that, and we were able to bargain a 12% increase sort of across the board. But we were only able to do that because we have a union, and the vast majority of my colleagues in the industry do not. We need transparency and accountability in these group homes, especially when we approve rate increases. Right now, there really does not seem to be an appropriate level of transparency or really any accountability when it comes to where Medicaid dollars are being spent. We have to ensure that they're being spent to improve the lives of the people we support and the people who support them. We need to know how our tax dollars are spent once they're allocated to these organizations. They're providing supports for some of our most vulnerable people. And I think we need clear and strong language with both stipulates how state money should be spent and empowers our legislatures to hold these agencies accountable at every level of administration. This year, the state legislature could have the opportunity to sign into a law a bill that contains the strong and empowering language that's needed to protect both Oregon taxpayers and the individuals that they pay to support. The state ultimately made a commitment when Fairview closed that Oregonians with disabilities would be well supported in the community. The only way to ensure this is that DSPs are paid a living wage so they don't have to worry about on their off time taking care of themselves. And just as individuals in the care of skilled nursing facilities are assured that their funds are spent to actually make their lives better, the public needs a commensurate level of transparency in group homes that can ensure us that the state is fulfilling its promise to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi.
Welcome.
good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. I'm Emily Sokolsky. I'm a senior researcher for the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. I appreciate the opportunity to share 503's perspective on Senate Bill 238 and our support for raising wages for direct support professionals. It's clear that low wages have made it difficult to attract new workers and contribute to an estimated 90% of turnover annually. The costs associated with turnover and the dependence on overtime are clearly expensive. So consistent with 503's mission to improve wages and working conditions for direct care workers, our union supported HB 5206, Policy Package 111, which passed in the 2015 session. Package 111 was intended to increase DSP wages by 4% from the modeled wage of $10.80 an hour to $11.23. And I call this a wage model because it does not correspond to what DSPs are actually paid, but it's used to develop a Medicaid reimbursement rate paid to group home providers. In addition, both DHS and the providers believe the model was $10.80 when the 4% increase passed. However, the model was actually predicated on a DSP wage of $12.94. So the 2015 increase should have led to an average wage of $13.45. 503's research department started to look at entry-level wages posted on Craigslist and provider websites between September 12th and September 23rd, 2016. We reviewed job postings associated with 33 providers. Of those postings, 14 providers advertised a starting wage below $10.80, and all were below $12.94. A table summarizing this research is included in my written testimony. So this is why 503 is advocating for a direct wage pass-through, which will require a minimum, not an average wage of $15 an hour. We understand that providers were asked by ODDS to report by September 30th how the 4% increase was implemented. And although we haven't seen a summary of that research, we understand that ODDS has stated that all the providers passed the increase along. We believe there needs to be a better reporting mechanism to ensure that providers are in compliance with whatever model is adopted this session. Financial transparency will help advocacy groups, ODDS, and the legislature understand what beyond labor is driving operating costs. So while 503 supports increasing DSP wages, we believe that additional reforms are also needed to protect the autonomy and rights of individuals receiving supports and services. These reforms include requiring case managers to explicitly inform individuals that independent living is an option, raising penalties for substantiated abuse so that they're consistent with the fines levied in other long-term care sectors, enhancing protections for mandatory reporters, requiring annual inspections, and requiring providers to staff according to an individual support plan rather than a minimum staffing ratios defined in statute. We hope these elements will lead to comprehensive reforms in the group home sector, provide more opportunities for independent living, and ensure that both individuals working in the sector and receiving support are treated with dignity and respect. And to close, we also wanted to echo our support of the concerns that AFSCME raised earlier in this panel about not pre-selecting a training curriculum. Great. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. And I'm going to stop us from questions just because we're at the time and we've still got one more panel. Is that anything burning? Okay, great. Thank you all very much. And so we've got last panel, Anna Keenan Mudrick, Brianna Sanders, and Shane Clay. Have I missed anybody that signed up that thinks they signed up and I never said your name? All right. And you've been so patient, and I have to ask you to be brief because we're about to lose the hearing room.
Oh, my gosh, Senator Gelser, you're asking Anna Keenan Mudrick to be brief. Many others have already asked
that. I believe in you.
It's okay. Okay. I am going to do my best to be as brief as possible because really these are the more important people here than I. But just to introduce myself very quickly, dear Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Anna Keenan Mudrick. I'm the Executive Director of Community Access Services, a provider agency that operates in the Portland Metro counties and also in Columbia County. And we serve and support around 170 individuals, some of which are kids, most of whom are adults who experience developmental disabilities, and we employ around 230 direct support professionals. So wanted to, I'll just quickly, I don't want to restate what everyone else has, but just in general, really emphasizing, of course, what an incredible DSP crisis we have before us, with lots of information from many of us that really reinforces this. I don't believe that's in dispute. It seems awfully clear. And, you know, there are many reasons why this is the case that have been stated, certainly, including the budget assumption built into the model of now with the 4% increase, $11.23 an hour on average. And I know that there have been indications too, and certainly as we've been digging into the model, as was just brought up, there's some information in some of the rebar rate model building that was done that does indicate some of the calculations that were built in there were based on an assumption of $12.94 an hour. Many of us have been perplexed by that because certainly that's not anything we can afford and we would desperately love to. We have put a lot of time and energy and commitment into fighting for our staff and trying to find a way to increase wages and make that work, and that just doesn't pan out in the long run, but boy, we'd love for it to. So what we've discovered in doing a lot of calculations is that really, as Joanne from PCL mentioned earlier, that the number of staffing hours assumed in the rate model are far too low. So therein lies a problem, but that is something then that many of us who are involved on the state task force and work groups that are working on the remodeling of the rates are raising and saying these are the actual number of hours that we are providing the support that are required to meet health and safety needs, because obviously it's not going to be very useful if we build in a rate that we all want and agree upon is needed and necessary and fair. If we don't have the number of hours to support that in our model, then you know, that's a problem. So just wanted to emphasize that and say I also included some information about that in my testimony as well. Also want to emphasize that the number that's built into there is an average. So part of what we have to do, of course, is make sure that we have enough money in our budget to pay staff who've been with us longer and in more intensive DSP positions a higher rate. So wanting, again, just to emphasize that even if there's an established average, that that's not necessarily what we can start at in our pay, although many of us would obviously really love to. Then trying to think of anything else that I can do to keep this brief, because many things, again, have already been stated as far as competition with other industries that have been unprecedented. And I know that Brianna is going to speak to that as well when others are leaving us for housekeeping, other care industries, customer service, retail, who are paying more, which just breaks my heart. It's just awful, and it shouldn't be. So
we're down to about, we have 5 minutes before we have to leave.
Okay. Okay. Oh, shoot. Okay. I am going to go ahead then and pass it on to these incredible people, only to say, just in closing for myself, that this is an incredibly stressed workforce, but they are so worth retaining. They are incredible people. I'm someone who was a DSP years ago. Most of us executive directors were DSPs at one point in time and have family members who experience developmental disabilities. It's important. We need to keep people safe, and that is more and more at risk the more we struggle to recruit and retain, and they deserve it. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm Shane Clay, and I'm here on a for my staff over here at Brown Laundry.
Fantastic. And can you lean back a little bit?
Don't say that better.
That's perfect. They're very powerful microphones.
Okay. And I was just going to let you know how great these people are. At one time, I had a staff that I really did like, and I had to do it with another lady, and it just didn't work out, and they changed it just to where I could, work it out with that other lady that I really, really did like at the time. So thank you very much. I'm glad to be here today.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad that you came.
Hello, Chair.
Gelser.
Yes. Vice Chair Olson and committee members. I'm Brianna Sanders. I work for Community Access Services. I'm a DSP at a day center. I take care of 22 different individuals Monday through Friday. Our turnover rate is astronomical. I am the senior staff. I have one person ahead of me by 2 weeks, and I haven't even been there a year yet. On a weekly basis, I am asked and begged by some of my individuals not to leave because they don't like new caregivers. It's not they don't like them. They don't like trying to learn about them and teach them about themselves. The pay is not enough. I have 2 children of my own by choice, obviously. The wages, if I want to do what I do, I have to choose between a comfortable life or caring for other people, which a lot of us do. So I don't really have time for everything else that I was going to say, but the wage definitely needs to change. I can make more money waitressing than doing what I do, and that's just not right.
Right. Thank you all so very much. Are there questions for this panel? We're seeing none. Thank you all. I mean, this is obviously an issue. I agree with all that's been said in regards to the desperate need for improved wages. This is an emergency. This is an incredibly important workforce that is serving a population of people that are deserving of high-quality, well-trained, consistent, reliable, respected workforce. I know that we've got a number of bills in the building, a number of places that we're talking about this, but I think as we look at the challenging budget that we have, investing in this workforce to me doesn't seem to be something that's optional. It seems to be something that is urgent and mandatory, and I look forward to continuing the conversations in a way that demonstrate our respect for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and the people that support them. So thank you all so much for taking the time to come and share your stories, and I know this is just the beginning of a lot of conversation. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 238, and we're adjourned.